Perhaps the most important element in our childhood, once we moved to the, even when we were in grammar school, my mother would let us take the number 7 trolley, which ended at Fairmont, and take it down to the zoo. And she would give us a brown paper bag lunch, and we would get off, and we were allowed to stay until 4:30, be home for dinner by 5 or something. We lived in that zoo.
Oh, that's great.
We loved that zoo. Oh. We became so bonded to animals that that has affected my life. This charitable trust I operate now is an animal welfare organization.
Right.
And we always had pets. My brother and I had white rats. We had mice. We had birds that had fallen out of the nest. We had injured rabbits and any animal that came onto the grounds that had been in a fight or was too young and the mother had probably been killed or something, we would nurture them back to health. And we had a great problem with the cats we loved and the birds we loved, and the cats loved the birds. So my brother and I designed these metal screens that you put around the branch of a tree so the cat could go up, but he couldn't get past them. So all of the trees around the house had these metal screens on them so that the birds could come. We loved watching the birds. First of all, romancing. The guy's following her around and she's ignoring him. Then suddenly they decided to settle down and they're out bringing back twigs and leaves and stuff to make the nest. And we would put out little piles of things they could use. And they'd go up and they'd build this nest and then she would lay the eggs and then we would watch the eggs hatch. I mean, it's like a nature lesson that you could possibly have in the center of the city.
That's right.
I mean, it was... And, oh, I got to tell you, the trick of the week, my brother and I, it was not nice. But there were lots of snakes.
Oh, yes.
And we had pictures of rattlesnakes, and we knew what was dangerous. There weren't too many dangerous snakes, but there were rattlesnakes down in the canyons. But garter snakes were another matter. Garter snakes are constrictives. They crush the mouse and then take it. So they can't hurt a person because they're not big enough. We had a giant boulder in our front yard in Shangri-La, and it was like a sun bath. These garter snakes would crawl out on there and lie in the sun and go into a coma. And some of these snakes were 5 and 6 feet long. So my brother and I would go out there, and we would see which ones were really in a coma, and we would wrap them around our waist 3 or 4 times. And then we'd go in the house and ask our mother to make lemonade. And she'd be cutting the lemons and she's getting the ice. And suddenly she's looking down. Here are these... Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
Here are these snakes wrapped around our waist. And she starts screaming, get those snakes out of my house and don't ever do that again. I'll never make you lemonade. That and climbing long trees.
That's great.
She said, if you fall out of a 10-foot tree, you'll sprain your ankle.
Oh.
If you fall out of a 30-foot tree, you'll break your neck. You are not to climb tall trees. And why do you want to climb tall trees? One time we were like 25 feet off the... Why are you way up there? Because we could see more. Oh. That was our simple answer. Back to...
Yeah.
Gastrocomtinis.
Yeah.
It made a lot of sense to us.
Makes sense.
We wanted to see what we can't see from the ground.
Yeah.
Oh, and I forgot to tell you about my garden.
Okay.
When we lived in Shangri-La, I discovered underneath the dirt and the soil that somebody had once had a beautiful home there with a big garden. All of these rock things that they designed in the ground, and I cleaned all that out and I discovered it. And we found out from neighbors that the people that lived there raised chickens and had big vegetable gardens and all kinds of stuff. And they said, it's all hidden now. The old wreck that was on the edge of the campus before you went into the grounds, went into wilderness, had been a chicken coop.
Hmm.
So I decided these damn foxes and birds and everybody that eat all of my growings, I'm going to plant them inside the screened chicken coop. And of course it was very fertile soil, and my mother just went crazy. She said, we can't eat all of these watermelons. We can't eat all this squash. We can't eat all this corn. We can't eat all these string beans. I said, well, we'll give them to the neighbors. She said, well, that would be nice probably. Some of them probably could use them. because I was cranking out enough vegetables for five families. I mean, I had fantastic stuff because the soil was good. And I watered them every night.
That's great.
And I checked the fence to be sure nobody could get in, because if I hadn't had the fence around it, the rabbits and the animals would have devoured everything. One day I'm out watering at the end of the day, and suddenly my string beans start disappearing, just coming down the pole slowly and going into the ground. And I ran in the house. I was terrified. I said, "Mother, you got to come and see this immediately." She thought someone had been hurt. She comes around and she saw this string bean plant going down, and she started laughing. She says, "It's the gophers, you fool. They're underneath where they live.
Oh.
And they took a little nibble on the roots of your string bean plant and found out it really tastes good. Let's go get all of them." So I started running all my hoses underground, trying to drown them out. It's impossible. You can't do that with gophers. But I'll never forget the shock.
Yeah.
And seeing these plants disappear, it made no sense.
Right.
My mother thought it was very funny.
Well, apparently you
But I want to emphasize the zoo, because it cost
great.
Us maybe a nickel if it cost us anything, because we were children. And we just loved the zoo.
What did you like in particular? Do you remember?
I'm sorry?
What in particular did you like? Which animals? Or?
Well, we never took the bus. We walked. And sometimes we said, "Let's go visit the antelopes and the deer," and then we would pick a section. It also had a merry-go-round.
Okay.
And maybe it was nickel a ride. And if you got the gold ring, you could get like five free rides. And we were very good at getting the gold ring. After you do it enough, you know how to do it.
Yeah.
But we loved it. And to tell a good story about Connie Dowell, Connie asked me the first time she went away to Vanderbilt, or I went away from San Diego, and I came back, she said, "Now where would you like to go?" She said, and I said, "Well, I'd like to have a nice lunch, and then could we go to the zoo?" She said, "They have a lovely lunch place in the zoo."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Really?" So, and it's like you're eating up in a treehouse.
Yeah.
You've been there?
Yeah.
Oh, it was wonderful.
It's great.
And then she said, "Well, now what would you like to see?" I said, "Something I know you have not seen in this zoo." And she said, "Really?" And she said, "Are you going to tell me what it is?" And I said, "Well, I think I'd like to surprise you, but then again, maybe I should tell you." Anyway, I had to go and double check where they were. So I take her to this place, and it's a round cage, and then it's like a shower curtain that was on rings, and it's all blocked off, and you can go inside to look, and it's where they have the smallest marsupial, they're monkeys really, the marsupials, in the world. The mother is this big, and when she's holding the child, he's this big. And I was just fascinated by them.
Yeah.
But they had to be sheltered, and you couldn't have rapid movement. You never knocked on the glass because they were very sensitive. And when I took Connie in there, she was just overwhelmed.
Oh,
she said, "I didn't know such a thing even existed."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, I discovered them. They have them off in a corner where it's quiet, and they don't advertise them. They don't want a lot of kids going there banging on the glass."
Right.
That and the big giant turtles and some of those things that we always visit. But anyway, the zoo was a wonderful freebie. Not that I didn't start going to the art museums and the historical societies and those things. I evolved into those things.
Well, you know, you paint a picture of having a childhood that, although there were some difficulties, was rich.
You don't say some. Because to a child, they're traumatic. Okay,
right.
I could hardly talk about my grandmother.
Yeah.
What she went through, tried to make up for her son. It was really awful to watch. So where are we?
What I was trying to say is that you went to the zoo, and your brother and your sister, and you had adventures.
I couldn't help my brother, but he didn't want any help, so that kind of helped me focus on my sister. But I could tell that, you know, she was just emotionally fragile.
Yeah.
Really. And scared of her own shadow. And even when she started dating, and later when she was an adult, she showed very poor judgment in the men she picked. She wanted very strong, very tough, very protective people. And she got some lose.
Yes.
Really. They did protect her. One of them didn't want her talking to me on the phone so much.
Oh, my.
He was jealous of her own brother talking to her long distance.
Oh, my.
She kind of laughed at that. I said, I don't think that's funny. I think that he's got problems. Mm-hmm. But he was Hispanic. And, you know, I am the man of the house. He did take very good care of my sister. They moved out to the beach area. They had a lovely apartment and everything. Then he got sick and died. She had to nurse him till he died. Then I moved her out to the La Mesa area and put her in an enclosed area, very nice units and fairly expensive. But her kids just wouldn't respond and go and see her as much as I wanted them to. I did that because they said, we don't want to drive all the way out to the beach to hear mother complain about things that she could tell us on the phone. And, you know, the teenage attitude mm-hmm. in young kids. And because she'd been not an easy woman to live with. Mm-hmm. And I put her out there in a really nice apartment, but her health was failing. She had rheumatoid arthritis, killed her.
Hard.
Well, I think what happened was they got her out to the best doctors at the hospital in La Jolla, the medical hospital out there. And I think they experimented because they could see this rheumatoid arthritis was moving rapidly through her body, and they didn't have any cure, but they had some things that they'd experimented with. And I think by the time they tried all their experiments, they made it even worse.
And that's sad.
Because I had to fly to New York or to San Diego for a very painful, the kids called me finally and said, she's in terrible, terrible shape, and they don't know what to do. And I flew out there, and we decided we should let her go.
Yeah. Well, would you...
That was tough.
That is tough. I said, that is very tough.
Yeah.
Can you backtrack a little to high school and to the club?
Well, you talked about, I think I skipped over that. I had to hurry home every day because I was working from 3:30 to 6:30 or something, uncrating washing machines and TV sets and electrical equipment and stuff, and that was my job. So yeah. I was really good with a screwdriver and a hammer and a wedge, but it was out on the street. They had all these crates out on the street waiting for me, and if I didn't show up, they couldn't put them in the store the next day. They weren't happy. But I took jobs at any place I could, you know. A couple of little bookstores that you would hire me temporarily, but they weren't making any money, so they couldn't keep me on. Just little places running around. I lived in Herwig and Romine was the best bookstore. Well, I won't say that, in San Diego, because Valverde's store, Warren Brock's, was a good store, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in those stores when I could get downtown. That's where I had my Bank of America account. I was so proud of that. $16 one month, $12 the next month, but it was my bank account. And when I would find a rare book, I would go searching. And I would find a book that was worth $50 or $100, which was a lot of money then.
Right.
I would put that in the Bank of America little vault thing that I had until I could find a buyer, pinching nickels and dimes. But later, with the skills that I had developed, I became really, I wanted to be the best rare book bibliographical searcher on the West Coast, and I became that. I found fantastic things. I was living in South Mission Beach when I was teaching, because I loved the beach. And so I got a couple of fraternity brothers. We rented a three-bedroom, two-bedroom place on South Mission. And now don't let me lose my thought here. I think
talking about being the best.
About what?
Finding rare books was
oh,
really
yeah,
the best.
So I started going to auctions and to bookstores all over the county. And there was a woman in Pacific Beach who ran an ad, Mrs. Porter. And she said, I've inherited from my family a lot of stuff from the estate of my great aunt or something. And they shipped it all to me, and I live in a little beach cottage. And I've got to sell it, so, you know, if you're interested, come. So she said she had a desk, and I really needed the desk to work at. So I got on a bicycle, and I went over to Pacific Beach from South Mission. She had a carpet that would be too big for this floor. And they sent it to her, and she's in a little cottage. It was just what other people didn't want back east. Obviously, it was a very wealthy family. Well, she had a little antique French desk, which was absolutely no value to me at all. But when I opened the drawers just to look at it, the drawers were filled with letters from the early Arizona Territory in the north where they discovered the silver mines.
Wow.
And these were original letters. And I said, well, I don't really want the desk, but I'd be happy to buy these. Well, I was going to throw all those out before I sold the desk. And I said, well, what do you want for them? She said, $25. Mm-hmm. So I was very happy. I took them and I cataloged them and I researched them. And I sold them to Warren Howe in San Francisco for like $2,000.
Fantastic.
Well, they were the history of the first discovery of the silver mines of Arizona. Mm. And they had these wonderful headlines, you know, that showed coaches with horses, and it would be the name of the silver mine company. Mm. And these were all business letters that talked about the values. I mean, it was very important historical stuff. But then I found in that same desk a letter written by a woman who had studied to be a school teacher. But she also was very religious. She lived in the eastern seaboard. And she was going to go and teach the savages out of the west coast.
Oh.
So she went with a party of pioneers who were crossing the country. And she stopped in Indiana for a while and became involved teaching there, probably needed the money. And she had, with her letters, all the history of a very important cultural organization that the Historical Society in Indiana knew existed but had no records at all of anything about it, and she had all the records.
Oh,
and I sold those for maybe $1,000. Oh. But what she really had was her Overland Narrative letter. And what she did was, because paper was so scarce, she would write a letter here, and she would keep writing. She would get the dates of where they were as they crossed. And then she would write it over here and then start on the next one. Then when all those pages were filled, she turned it upside down and she would write between the lines upside down. And when those were all filled up, she wrote across. And it was almost impossible to copy it.
Yeah.
But we were able to do so.
Wow.
And it turned out to be 1844, the only known woman Overland Narrative extant.
Oh.
That's how rare the letter was. And when they reached the eastern seaboard of the Rockies, they tore the wagon down to the bed, the wheels, and the steering mechanism, because it was the first wagon, basic wagon wheel vehicle, to get over the Rockies. I mean, it had great historical significance. And she was traveling with a very important Catholic priest who had been back and forth preaching. And he was in the party that she was in. Well, she finally reached Washington, which is where she was going, and then she signs up and gets a teaching job and kind of disappears. But this six-page letter written on 24 pages, I sold for the Coe collection at Yale through Warren Howe, the leading rare book dealer on the West Coast, for something like $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000.
Mm.
These were all stuffed in the drawers of this desk.
Mm, amazing.
And that's the kind of thing that got me started.
Well, that's such an...
Because I learned my skills.
Wonderful.
And San Diego State gave me a research grant one summer when I was teaching. And I used it to go out to Yale because the leading authority on 20th century bibliography was Donald Gallup at the Beinecke Library.
Right.
And I wrote him a letter and told him how much I admired his... He created a new system. How much I admired it. And I wondered if I could come and spend some time with him. He said, let's do an independent studies. My basement is down underneath the ground of the Beinecke. Nobody will bother us. And, you know, you can come back and spend a couple weeks or a month or whatever. And so I got to know him very well. I found a major error in his very famous bibliography on Ezra Pound. And he never forgot me after that.
I'm sure.
I was sitting there one day in the office and I said, Donald, why did you indent the subtext of the contributions to books in your Pound bibliography, which was part of the Soho series, a very, very prestigious series? He said, what are you talking about?
Mm.
And I said, well, you've done something that it doesn't fit any of the patterns of what you do. He said, give me that book. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, look how this is set in three spaces instead of two, this whole section. Am I supposed to do that when I work in? He said, oh my God. He said, all the proofing, All my graduate students went through this. I went through this, and none of us saw that. Oh, my God. He said, Andres, I'll have to get that into another printing. He said, you have a good eye. Mm-hmm. See, I established a beachhead.
That's right.
That wasn't my purpose. I thought, really, he was doing something that had a reason. I wasn't trying to be a smarty pants. I respected him too much. And it turned out that he was a very old close friend of Francis Dellop's. That as a student at Yale, he had come to the Gotham Bookmark many, many times, and he had established a friendship with her. So when he found out I bought the Gotham Bookmark, then I really was in with him. You can see why this is going to be a problem. It's very stylized, and he's having some fun, but...
Yeah, I think that would be really good.